This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. It's not every day that a mathematician plays the hero in a Hollywood spy thriller, but that is precisely what happens in The Imitation Game, starring Benedict Cumberbatch as Alan Turing. The movie, of course, debuted this past weekend. The real Turing was many things: a World War II cryptanalyst who was instrumental in breaking the German Enigma code, a founding father of computer science. He was also an elite marathoner and an openly gay man in a time when that was illegal. Turing was criminally prosecuted and cruelly punished for his homosexuality. Given a choice between incarceration and chemical castration, he chose the latter. He committed suicide 2 years later, at the age of just 41, and there remains a debate as to how much a factor that punishment was. Although his life was short, his legacy is evident in the digital devices that suffuse every one of our lives every day. But a movie about Turing's life is particularly timely this year. Here's why. In 1952, the year that Turing began the course of chemical castration, he published a manuscript, not about computers, at least not directly, but about something that has become a fundamental concept in biology: the idea that chemical signals guide the development of the all-capable stem cells into the fully mature skin, heart, blood, brain. You get the idea, the cells that make up every living creature. Bringing things full circle, two scientists from Brandeis University earlier this year published an experimental confirmation of Turing's theory just months after the British government issued a royal pardon to Turing. Irving Epstein is Henry F. Fishbach Professor of Chemistry in the Volan National Center for Complex Systems at Brandeis University, and he was a co-author on the paper Testing Turing's Theory of Morphogenesis. He joins me now from a studio at WGBH. Irving Epstein, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, Irving, I have to ask first, have you seen the movie or do you plan to?
I didn't get a chance this weekend with Thanksgiving festivities, but I definitely plan to see it, hopefully next week.
Have you heard any buzz, any rumors about it? Are you thinking that it did a good job of portraying Alan Turing?
I've heard mixed things about that, and I'm eager to see for myself.
Well, how and when did you first encounter Alan Turing's work?
I'd been studying unusual chemical reactions that give rise to oscillations in the concentrations of certain chemicals. And we, after building a number of reactions of this type, looked at them not only in time but in space, and discovered that they formed patterns. The patterns we saw were moving patterns like spirals and rings that would expand. But in reading about patterns in general, I came across Turing's work, the one paper that he published in chemistry, along with all the great papers on math and computer science. And that was the first time that I learned about his work in chemistry.
Tell us more about these reactions. How does a chemical reaction — this does indeed sound very unusual, as you said — how does a chemical reaction form a spiral?
Well, basically, you have two processes, one called activation, in which some chemical species starts growing in concentration faster and faster. The more you have, the more it builds up. And then there's another process called inhibition or negative feedback that tends to quench the activation reaction. And if you get a spot of activation that starts to spread, then if it spreads for a while and then the inhibition takes over and slows it down, you get, if the system is stirred, you get oscillations, increases and decreases in time. But if you spread out the reaction in space, then you get spatial patterns.
What was Alan Turing's role in thinking about these kinds of chemical reactions and the formations of those patterns?
Well, he had the rather profound insight that diffusion, which is the process by which chemical species spread out in space and mix, think of putting a drop of red food coloring into a glass of water. Over time, that bright drop will spread out until eventually you have a uniform pink solution. So diffusion normally destroys spatial structure, but Turing had the insight that if you combined diffusion with the kind of chemical reactions, the activation and inhibition that I mentioned a minute ago, that you had the possibility of creating rather than destroying pattern. And he saw that one might think about that in the context of biological morphogenesis, that is, the differentiation of initially uniform cells into different kinds of cells, whether it's blood or brain or bone or skin.
So he published some of his thoughts on this in a paper in 1952 called The Chemical Basis of Morphogenesis. What was so groundbreaking about that? How much did he contribute to the field of biology as essentially a complete outsider?
I think it's fair to say that he created a field within biology of the theoretical study of morphogenesis. For 40 years after the publication of Turing's paper, there was a sort of cottage industry of people who called themselves mathematical biologists who expanded on Turing's idea and developed models of pattern formation in biological systems, even though it took 40 years for the first experimental demonstration that Turing's idea might be relevant in chemical systems.
When I first encountered your experiment several months ago and began learning about Turing's thoughts on morphogenesis, I have to say I was kind of surprised. I was a biology major in college. I went through 6 years of graduate school essentially doing developmental biology, took all sorts of courses where we talked about how developing embryos create patterns in different types of cells and all of these things. And Alan Turing's name never came up in any of that. Does that surprise you?
A little bit, although I think the tendency in most biology departments is to focus on the experimental aspects rather than the theoretical ones. And Turing's work for many decades after he did it lay in the realm of the theoretical, that no one had been able to identify the activator and inhibitor that in a real biological system that Turing proposed as the source of morphogenesis. So I think that biology courses tended to ignore Turing's work, A, because there was no experimental demonstration of it, and B, because it is rather mathematical and theoretical.
I mean, but the idea that there was some organizing force, that there's actually a part of embryos called the organizer, and that idea predates Turing's work by decades. So was what he was doing really putting out a completely new idea, or was he putting forward perhaps a theoretical explanation for phenomena that were already being observed in biological systems?
I think he was making the idea more concrete and demonstrating that morphogenesis, cell differentiation, was consistent with the fundamental laws of chemistry, physics, and mathematics. Before that, one might have a notion of an organizer, but if you couldn't make that more precise, then it was unclear whether that came out of the same laws that governed simple chemical systems or required some extra biological principle.
In case you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Irvin Epstein. He's the Henry F. Fishback Professor of Chemistry at Brandeis University. And we're talking about his work following in the footsteps of Alan Turing, who was not only a founding father of computer science, but also made some important contributions to biochemistry and even developmental biology. Irving Epstein, let's talk about the work that you published with a whole team from Brandeis University earlier this year, testing this idea of Alan Turing's, that you could essentially chemically put out a signal and change the nature of essentially cells or the chemical reactions nearby to create patterns. The confirmation that you published was in a completely non-biological, a completely physical construct of a system. Why wouldn't you test this actually in a biological system, say in an embryo, where all of these cells are talking to each other and changing into different things?
Well, the easy answer is we're chemists, but I think more practically, it's not so straightforward to find a ring of cells, which was basically what Turing studied, that have not yet differentiated, and study them at exactly the right time. And it's at this stage not possible to identify the activator and inhibitor chemicals in those cells. With our system, which is a rather simple chemical system, we can identify the activator and the inhibitor, and we can see the changes in the cells very easily because when the reaction goes on, the system changes from red to blue and vice versa and back and forth.
So you can literally watch patterns of red and blue appearing in these reactions. What scale are we talking about?
We're talking cells, which are basically little droplets of water, of 100 micrometers or about a 25th of an inch in diameter.
Now, when you first published this work, I don't know actually if it was you or your co-author, Seth Fraden, who said that in the instant where you saw these chemical drops shining different color lights and looked at them through a microscope, that it was a very moving moment and it was almost Frankensteinish. What would be Frankensteinish about watching chemical droplets creating red and blue light?
Well, it wasn't so much the red and blue light as the fact that in conjunction with the color change, the cells changed size. And that was really the Frankenstein moment, because we'd seen red blue changes in beakers full of this reaction, but the fact that some cells got bigger and some cells got smaller meant that this could be the beginning of division into cells that would have different functions if this were a biological organism.
The idea that Turing put forward, as you've said, of chemical morphogenesis, whether or not biology classes are teaching Alan Turing's theory specifically and mentioning his name, has essentially become received wisdom in the field of biology, that this is what's happening. Cells are communicating via chemicals and changing each other to create these different patterns within our bodies, within other animals and plants' bodies. If it has become such an entrenched part of modern science, what was the need in your mind to test or confirm or demonstrate this theory again?
Well, science is about proving, or I should say, disproving theories. One can never absolutely prove a theory, but one can do lots of tests of a theory, and if none of them disprove the theory, that strengthens the validity of the theory. And there have been very few opportunities to actually test Turing's theory in real experiments. So this was an ideal moment to really take a look in conditions about as close to the ones that Turing described in his theoretical paper as one could get, whether one could actually see the kind of cell differentiation that he envisioned.
And what was the opportunity that made this possible now, or could this type of experiment and this type of confirmation have happened, 10, 20, 30 years ago?
Well, there's been an experimental advance over the past decade or so, actually carried out by physicists and engineers, something called microfluidics, which makes it possible by using very narrow streams of liquid to create arrays of tiny droplets of water or oil or other substances, and to incorporate into them chemicals that will undergo reaction. And without the microfluidic technique, which my colleague Seth Fraden is a master of, one would not have been able to do this experiment.
I actually visited Seth Fraden's lab over the summer, and they were showing me these almost like snowflake patterns and various different geometric designs that they had, as you said, kind of etched into these to make very microscopic channels of this fluid, and then watching them flash red and blue. I mean, almost artistic and really quite beautiful to look at.
Yeah, I think the aesthetic element has attracted a number of us into this field.
Was there a sense the first time that you saw this working, almost of perhaps vindicating Alan Turing?
Well, I don't think Alan Turing needs much vindication, not only because of his incredible work in math and computer science, but the fact that he wrote one paper in chemical biology and spawned dozens and dozens of new insights and investigations into the field. Nevertheless, to the extent that we could help show further the importance of Turing's work, that certainly was a very satisfying thing.
I was actually looking around on Google last night, and the paper that Turing published, The Chemical Basis of Morphogenesis, according to Google, has been cited almost as many times, about 8,500 times, as opposed to 10,000 times for the paper announcing the structure of DNA. Would you say that those two papers are almost on par in terms of their importance?
I think time will tell. I think certainly the structure of DNA has had a greater impact thus far, and it's on a more microscopic level. I think Turing's work, which has more macroscopic implications, may turn out to be almost as important as the DNA structure, perhaps as important, but I think we won't know that for a number of years.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest today is Irving Epstein. He's the Henry F. Fishbach Professor of Chemistry in the Volan National Center for Complex Systems at Brandeis University, itself quite a complex title. We will talk more about the life and mind of Alan Turing after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Alan Turing may not have the popular name recognition of Albert Einstein or Leonardo da Vinci, but those who know his work have compared him to both. So what made Turing so great? Irving Epstein is Henry F. Fishbach, Professor of Chemistry at Brandeis University and co-author of a recent paper testing one of Turing's lesser-known theories about biology. He joins me today from a studio at WGBH. Irving Epstein, Turing is largely remembered today as the founding father of computer science. He was way ahead of his time. In 1936, he actually had an idea for what he called the universal Turing machine, which is essentially the predecessor to the modern computer. He built one of the first computers. In 1950, he came up with a test for artificial intelligence that is still used today. How central is Turing's work in computer science to this sense that Turing could be possibly the most important scientist of the 20th century, could be on par with people like Epstein and Da Vinci?
I wouldn't include Epstein in there.
Excuse me, Einstein.
I think one can make a very good case that he is up there in the pantheon. He was a real polymath. I mean, he when he turned his attention to a field, he nailed it. He had a knack for picking the important problem and always had a novel way of approaching it. So I think one can certainly make the case.
I mean, as you said, he was a polymath. He spent time thinking about relativity, about quantum mechanics. We've been talking about his theorizing in biochemistry. And there seems to be a theme in a lot of his work where you say he brought a novel approach to things, but it was almost like he was reinventing the wheel. He wasn't necessarily taking on a completely new problem, but he would come at it with a different tack, come at it completely independently of those other thinkers, and sometimes end up at a better result than previous people had been able to reach.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think his approach was sort of almost philosophical. Is what can we know? I mean, his fundamental work in computer science and the development of this idea of a universal computing machine was part of his proof that there were certain questions whose answers could not be computed. And I think that idea sort of drove a lot of what he thought about.
Another theme in a lot of his work is an ability, as you said, to see what was really important and to simplify problems in a way without losing those key portions of it. Can you give us an example kind of how he would simplify a problem, perhaps in the realm of this biochemical question of morphogenesis, how he was able to simplify things in a way that actually made some of the complexities and the realities of the situation clearer?
Yeah, well, in the biochemical model that he developed, he basically throws away all of the biochemical machinery of the cell, the DNA and the proteins, and he simplifies it to an activator and an inhibitor, two chemicals, one that tends to increase, the other that tends to hold back that increase. And he added diffusion, a way that the cells could communicate with each other. And then he simply works through the mathematical implications of that and discovers that, in fact, if you have the right chemistry and the right relationship between the diffusion rates of the activator and the inhibitor, voila, the cells begin to differentiate.
That ability to see what is important and to simplify in clarifying ways as opposed to obscuring ways, to me, seems like genius. And I think it would be fair to say that Alan Turing was a genius, but perhaps stereotypically of a lot of geniuses, even like Einstein, it wasn't really recognized, say, by teachers. He got mediocre grades at best. Why wasn't his brilliance, do you think, recognized more in his day?
I think it has to do with the kind of innovation that he did. He wasn't willing to simply solve the problem in the standard way, but he preferred to go at it from new directions, and particularly in the early years of school, that doesn't always sit well with teachers who have to deal with large groups of students, most of whom need to do the problem in the standard way. And sometimes the innovation goes beyond what the teacher is prepared to think about or to understand. So I think it's not surprising that true geniuses sometimes are not appreciated by their schools.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Irving Epstein, the Henry F. Fishbach Professor of Chemistry at Brandeis University, and a bit of an Alan Turing scholar and aficionado. Irving, you mentioned this almost philosophical question that seemed to drive Turing about what is knowable, what is computable. But it's interesting. Of course, we are all products of our times. In terms of Alan Turing's schooling, science and math were seen as kind of mundane, perhaps not for the upper class, not for the gentry. And so he was almost discouraged away from a lot of this field of pursuit. You know, his mother would have preferred that he studied classics. Do you think he had this kind of question driving him from a young age to stick with this?
I think he probably did. I suspect he would have been a very good classicist and maybe broken new ground in that field. But yeah, I think he probably played with bugs and microscopes and mixed things together when he was a child and just became fascinated by that and was drawn to science as perhaps the most promising outlet for his curiosity.
How did Turing's biochemical theorizing fit in with his better known and overarching achievements in mathematics and computer science, things like artificial intelligence? Was it a complete departure or was there a connection between the two for him?
Well, it's hard to get into Turing's mind, but I suspect that some of the same questions that drove him about artificial intelligence also motivated his curiosity about biochemical systems. It's not that he never thought about chemistry. One of my colleagues actually went to Sherburne, the school that Turing attended as a boy, and by the time my colleague went there, Turing had become a noted alumnus, and there was a lot of lore about what Turing had been like as a student there. And one of the things was that he had won a prize for his study of chemistry as well. So he always had some curiosity about these kinds of issues, and I think the approaches that he used in questions of computer science may have carried over a bit into the way he approached biochemical systems.
Alan Turing, by all accounts, was a bit of a difficult person to work with, a very eccentric personality, but posthumously, he seems to, when people actually learn who he is and what his work was, seem to be drawn to him in a way almost as if he has a charisma. What for you draws you to Alan Turing? What makes him so interesting?
I think the combination of having done some really fundamental theoretical work of to the outsider, no practical importance, and the very, very successful applied science that he did, not only in developing the notion of a universal computing machine, but his work on the Enigma code during the war. Most scientists think of themselves either as basic scientists who work on problems out of pure curiosity, or as applied scientists, or the extreme being engineers, who work on problems for their practical implications. But Turing was able to be extremely successful in both domains, and that's quite unusual and I find quite appealing.
I have to say, I'm not immune to this effect either, that the first time I encountered Alan Turing was actually in a fiction portrayal of Turing's code breaking. And I went on to read a number of code breaking books about the history of code breaking and Alan Turing's work, and was quite taken with all of this. And so the first very simple computer program, very simple script that I ever wrote, was actually to try to make a version of the Hello World script that every computer coding course teaches you as your first one, but actually try to make it kind of a Turing machine that would count through. And there really is something about him that seems to just pull people in. It's quite amazing.
Yes. Of course, it's hard to know what the real Turing was like. I have also seen a couple of fictional portrayals, and I will look forward to seeing the movie. I'm sure he was a very powerful personality who drew people to him. How well he reacted to that, we don't know.
Now, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, Alan Turing was perhaps not fully openly gay, but openly gay, open with his friends about this fact. And in 1952 was actually criminally prosecuted for indecency, as it was called, for having a relationship with another man, and was punished with chemical castration. And during that, he wrote to a friend of his, a fellow mathematician, Norman Rutledge, that he worried that his intellectual theories, that all of his scientific and intellectual work would end up being outshined or even tarnished by the fact that he was homosexual. How much of an impact do you think that has actually had on his legacy?
I think much less than he expected. I think actually very little. He probably couldn't imagine a world in which homosexuality would no longer be criminalized, in which gay marriage would be legal in many places. And I think his concern was based on the assumption that the world, the social world, would not change. But I think the reality is that his sexual orientation has, while it may have created some interest in him as a person beyond his science, it really has not impacted his science and people's appreciation of it.
Now, of course, he received posthumously a royal pardon from the Queen of England last year for that criminal prosecution. But there's still quite a debate as to whether or not this punishment led eventually to his suicide. I mean, he continued to work. He seemed quite defiant during the actual course of estrogen that he received. It essentially made him impotent, which was one of the punishments used at that time. But, you know, he worried that this would, as we were talking about, tarnish his scientific reputation. It resulted in the loss of his security clearance. There were clearly devastating impacts to this prosecution and this punishment. Why, though, do you think there is such a debate? It seems when you ask someone, well, do you think that, you know, his homosexuality and this public punishment was a part of his suicide, people seem to fall very staunchly either into a yes camp or a no camp. Do you have any sense of why that is?
It may say more about the people who take these positions than about Turing. But there is even a debate. There's some recent scholarship that questions whether he actually did commit suicide, although there was cyanide found on the premises.
And it was a cyanide-laced apple, correct, that they actually killed
it's
him?
It's not clear whether the apple was actually tested for cyanide. The autopsy showed that Turing died from cyanide poisoning, but it's less clear whether the apple itself was tested. The apple was near the body. But I think the majority opinion is that he did indeed commit suicide. And one could imagine that the chemical treatments not only affected his sexual powers, but that he might have been worried that it was affecting his mental powers as well, and that might well have led him to a suicidal mood.
What do you think Alan Turing would make of today's world where same-sex marriage is now widely accepted and increasingly accepted, and almost all of us carry around a tiny computer in our back pocket?
Well, I think he would be much happier living in today's world than in the world of the 1940s and 50s. I think he would be gratified by the amazing results of the revolution that he set in motion. I think he would be idolized throughout the world.
Do you think he would find our current popular uses of computing, you know, phones, they're for communication, but we're playing Candy Crush Saga all the time. We're not necessarily using computers only to seek out what is perhaps knowable or unknowable. It's not all about great aspirations. Do you think he would find that disturbing or pleasing?
I think he might think it a bit frivolous, but I suspect he would still be pleased that computing was making the lives of many people more pleasant and more fun.
Irving Epstein, thank you.
Thank you.
That's Irving Epstein. He's the Henry F. Fishbach Professor of Chemistry at Brandeis University. He spoke to us about Alan Turing, a founding father of computer science, of course, and the inspiration for some of Epstein's own work. Up next, we're a change of topic here. You'll hear about efforts to help businesses in our region reduce their energy consumption. That's coming up after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. NSTAR and National Grid, the two suppliers of electrical power for Cape Cod, the coast, and the islands, recently announced plans to dramatically increase electricity rates in January. Residential customers could see their monthly electric bill increase by almost $30. But what about commercial ratepayers? Many businesses tend to consume significant amounts of energy. Think of a commercial linen service with dryers and presses, a hotel with all those lights and air conditioning units, or a grocery store with those massive fridges and freezers. I recently spoke with two people helping companies and businesses in our region reduce their energy consumption. Nicole Price-Vudrin is program manager at the Cape Light Compact, serving the Cape and Martha's Vineyard. And Ezra McCarthy is part of the Cape and Islands Program Strategy Team at NSTAR, serving Nantucket. Ezra McCarthy, Nicole Price-Vudrin, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you.
Now, for businesses that are just starting out, I imagine there are a number of ways that they could, from the ground up, create buildings that are more energy efficient. But let's talk about businesses that are already up and running. Both NSTAR and Cape Light Compact have programs specifically to help them become more energy efficient. Nicole, tell us a little bit about some of those programs.
Well, so NSTAR, National Grid, and Cape Light Compact are part of the Mass Save program, which the intent of the program is to have consistency across the state for businesses, residents, etc. So Ezra and I, we both work together on a statewide level to ensure consistency to the customers on Cape Cod and Martha's Vineyard, which is Cape Light Compact's territory, as well as Nantucket, which is National Grid Electric's territory. And for retrofit programs, which is for the existing building, the existing business, we have a few different paths that you can take. There is a prescriptive application path, which you get a per unit incentive. So if you take out an inefficient fluorescent lighting fixture and install a more efficient fluorescent lighting fixture or a more efficient LED, which is a light emitting diode, it's a new lighting technology fixture, there are incentives per unit that you retrofit. And there's also a custom program, which is through a custom application. for all sorts of measures, not just lighting. We have things for, we have programs for HVAC, which is heating, ventilation, and air conditioning. We have programs for motors and drives. What we like to tell people is just please get in touch with us because we do have a program that should be able to accommodate anybody in their energy needs.
And Ezra, in terms of businesses deciding what might be the right strategies for them to pursue, do they go through the same sort of energy audit that homeowners can, where someone comes to the business and looks around and says, oh, well, you're really in a good position to change your HVAC system, or you're really in a good position to take advantage of an insulation program?
They do. So we, all the program administrators utilize different vendors, different deliverers of energy efficiency services. So we have direct install vendors that will perform audits on customers' businesses and identify a plan for them to become more efficient.
Now, the process seems somewhat similar to a residential energy audit and trying to make a home more energy efficient. How different are the actual actions that a business might take, and why do you need a specific program for businesses, perhaps separate from homes?
Well, what we find in businesses is that their energy needs are different, and they also use energy different times of the day and in different ways than residences and homeowners. If you think of the typical home, they would use energy in the morning when they're getting ready and in the evening when they're home, but typically not throughout business hours because that's when folks are at their places of business, unless they work from home. But so businesses also tend to have more specialized pieces of equipment where you would look at a business as a segment. A hotel would have different energy needs than a grocery store, and they have much different equipment in each respective place, whereas most homes tend to have the same range of equipment. They all have some piece of heating equipment. They have a hot water heater. They have lighting needs. So the residential assessments are very, very thorough and turnkey, but they're looking at a lot of the same measures in the same homes. The commercial assessments are much more specialized to that particular type of business that's being looked at. So we wouldn't recommend a occupancy sensor on the HVAC unit for a hotel room in a grocery store. That just wouldn't make sense. So
I mean, I assume part of the difference is simply the fact that in a home, you have one family, a relatively small number of people. In a business, you could have many different employees, lots of different behavior patterns. It's hard to just tell everybody, hey, turn off the lights, or, you know, behavior changes might be a little bit harder to implement in a business setting. Are there technologies out there that can help with some of that to make a business more efficient without having to try to regulate the behavior of all of the employees?
Yes, absolutely. So the direct install path, which Ezra mentioned, it is a turnkey program. It is for customers that use less than 300 kW of average peak demand per month. And if any of the businesses have a question on whether they are within that threshold, on Cape and Martha's Vineyard, they probably are, statistically speaking. And also feel free to call your program administrator, whether it's Cape Light Compact, NSTAR, National Grid, et cetera, and we can help you, guide you into the right way. And we have energy specialists in these programs that are familiar with the different technologies that they would see across the breadth of type business end uses.
Ezra, are there challenges that you see for businesses on Nantucket that might be unique specifically to Nantucket or to island businesses in general?
We do with the seasonality of the businesses where they are operating full bore, generally May through September, and then kind of go onto a reduced schedule. They use energy, but they use it in a dense period of time, and that kind of affects some of their paybacks with certain measures where they don't have the run hours, where they're saving year round. It might take them a couple years to save what kind of a normally mainland business would that runs year-round.
Now, what if a business rents its physical space, doesn't own its own building? Can those businesses still take advantage of some of these programs to try to become more energy efficient?
Absolutely. They absolutely can. One place where Cape Light Compact differs from, to my knowledge, National Grid Electric on Nantucket, we offer a specific business tenant program for long-term tenants. It is through the direct install program. We offer increased incentives for business tenants within a certain usage threshold that have long-term leases with their landlords, and also the electric bill is in their name. So that is one thing we do ask during the energy assessment. If they're a long-term business tenant, if they meet our qualifications, we offer an increased incentive there.
And Ezra, how do businesses in general go about signing up for these programs? And have you seen a large response? Are businesses in our region really looking to take advantage of energy efficiency programs?
So businesses on Nantucket and I guess on the Cape, they would go through Cape Light Compact. But on Nantucket, they would call 800-332-3333 and get in touch with one of our direct install vendors.
Is that something a lot of businesses have done?
It is. There has been a lot of activity on Nantucket. There has been kind of differing degrees of success within certain business types due to the constraints that I mentioned earlier with seasonality and paybacks not meeting their investment thresholds. But we are able to work with most customers.
Nicole, what about on Cape Cod and on Martha's Vineyard?
So on Cape Cod and Martha's Vineyard, in order to get in touch with Cape Light Compact, please call us at 800-797-6699, and we'll get you signed up for either a residential or commercial energy assessment. But we have had wonderful participation in our programs, but that's not to say that it's fully subscribed or anything like that. We have the funding to support you in your energy efficiency needs, and we also have the expertise behind us to support that. So please give us a call.
Nicole, the Compact has also initiated a behavior feedback program where you help people better understand how much electricity they're using. So explain how that works.
The behavior feedback initiative is for both residents and business owners that do not have photovoltaic systems. And what we do through that program is install a piece of equipment on your electric meter at your home or business, and you actually install an app on your iPhone, your Android, which you're on your smartphone or tablet, and it works through the wireless internet of your home, which needs connectivity all the time in order to function. And it can show you near real-time energy usage for your home or business, which we're hoping will feed a behavioral change where if you're more cognizant of how much energy you're using at certain times a day or how much energy a certain piece of equipment uses, you may use less by knowing more.
So that is available for both homeowners and for businesses.
Yes, and there are still spots. If you're interested in signing up for Cape Light Compact's Behavior Feedback Initiative, I suggest you visit our website. We have a sign-up form. It's www.capelightcompact.org/smart, S-M-A-R-T.
Well, we will have links to more information on our website. Nicole Price-Voudrin, Ezra McCarthy, thank you both so much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Nicole Price-Voudrin is the program planner at the Cape Light Compact, serving the Cape and Martha's Vineyard. Ezra McCarthy is part of the Cape and Island Program Strategy Team at NSTAR, serving Nantucket. Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter or on Instagram. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support is provided by Lee McGraw through the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. Living Lab is a production of WCAI, the local NPR station for the Cape, the Coast, and the Islands.